88.3 Southern FM. The sounds of the Bayside.
Coming up right now is The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on the panel on Mission Control, we have Richard. On this week's program, we visit Melbourne University to hear about a student satellite plan.
When you've seen the Southern Cross for the first time, you'll understand that's why you came this way.
Melbourne University students launched a satellite way back in the 1960s. Oh, it was the 1970s, forget now. Anyway, and that was called Australis Oscar. Well, several years ago, they launched another one. A different group of people, of course, but still students. And that was called Acrux 1. Acrux, of course, means Alpha Crucis, which is the first star of the Southern Cross. Well, they got, after that success, they got together again and they started developing another satellite called Acrux 2. I recorded the following in 2022, August the 25th. In the hope that they would have their satellite in the following year or so. Well, guess what? I've tried to contact them a number of times since to find out what's happening, and they've gone quiet. I don't know whether they're still working on the project. Certainly the students we're going to hear from today would long since have graduated from the university. So I can't tell you whether this is going ahead or whether it's just something that's fallen by the wayside. Now, who's our first guest, Richard?
It looks like we've got Patrick Grave. Who is he, Andrew?
He's the chief executive officer of what this group is called. The group calls themselves the Melbourne Space Program.
And what will he be talking about this evening?
About building a satellite and how hard it is, the spin-offs from doing so, and one of the aims of Acrux 2 is actually to take a photo of Melbourne. And engineering and ambiguity. And he also introduces the speakers we're going to hear later.
Because tonight is a special night. And tonight is a special night because building a satellite is hard. It's so hard that back in 2019, when we launched Acrux 1, our flagship satellite at the Melbourne Space Program, it was the first Australian student satellite in 50 years. This team of students, with no prior experience, embedded engineers from industry. They negotiated launch contracts and funding, and they navigated regulatory hurdles, and they proved that all of this could be done. And since then, the depth and the scale of our projects have only grown. Just this year, Grace Brown and Tasnim Ahmed, two MSP engineers, spun out their company Andromeda from the Melbourne Space Program. They work tirelessly with mentors, students, and academics. They've been featured in Vogue magazine. They've won grants and they've entered accelerators, giving them a current valuation of $1.5 million. And they were simply following their dream of helping the elderly and providing companionship. So tonight, I present to you the dream of the Acrux 2 team. A dream they've worked on through the depths of COVID, in Zoom calls, in meeting rooms, at workshop benches, in lecture halls, around the dinner table. A dream to take a photo of Melbourne from space. To build a box that, while hurtling round the Earth at 7,000 metres per second, can stop spinning, can point at little old Melbourne, can charge up its batteries, and can take a photo. But we are not building a satellite simply because it is hard, but because of the vital skills that students gain by building a satellite. At university, you get set a time frame and a task. In engineering competitions, they give you a mission. Our satellites start with a blank slate. No scope, no requirements, no mission. And this is what engineering is about: managing ambiguity. To manage this ambiguity, the team engages mentors, industry partners, and academics. They pore through textbooks and papers. They ask naive questions, a lot of them. They make many, 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 many mistakes. But in their failure, they find success. And from this ambiguity, they grow. Graduates from MSP have worked at Boeing, Atlassian, Gilmore Space, Microsoft, Melbourne Space Labs. They've won awards like Defence Graduate of the Year, Australian Young Space Leader. They've won competitions, and they've founded four companies. But when you lie in your bed tonight, I don't want you just to know that building a satellite is hard, nor that it develops unparalleled skills. But I want you to know that with the support of each one of you here tonight, this will happen. To the MSP members in the audience, with your drive and tenacious persistence, with you, this will happen. To all the prospective members in the audience who want to become leaders, with you, this will happen. To all those in the audience who champion and share what we do, with you, this will happen. To those who funded this project so far, FEIT, Michelle McKay, Andrew Uy, with you, this will happen. To industry partners, academics, and mentors who can support this project financially or in kind, with you, this will happen. And to our policymakers, like Jenny Mitchell, who's here tonight from the Space Agency, with you, this will happen. Tonight, you will hear from the ACRUX 2 team about their development so far and what work remains in building Australia's first student imaging satellite. Then you will hear from Jenny Mitchell, Director of Civil Space Policy at the Australian Space Agency, about how the skills developed on this satellite prepare students for the 20,000 new jobs in Australian space by 2030. Then there'll be drinks, as well as the chance to speak to each of the subsystems you'll see tonight around the room. And when you leave tonight, I want you to know this. Building a satellite is hard, but it is essential to develop Australia's next generation of engineering leaders. And together, as a community of students, of mentors, of academics, and partners, we will make this happen. I now welcome Maxwell Jones, ACRUX 2 team lead, to talk about the ACRUX 2 mission.
Thank you, Patrick, for that fantastic address to kick us off. First of all, I just want to say just how amazing it is to be here tonight and to be sharing with you the amazing work that all of our sort of ACRUX 2 team has been up to, you know, in these last couple of weeks, but in the months and sort of years, I suppose, even before that. Honestly, like in my position, it is really inspiring just to kind of see everyone, like how they've come together, the work they've been able to achieve. Incredibly proud of what everyone's been able to accomplish. So, ACRUX 2. First things first. Well, what on earth is a CubeSat, right? So, some of you might have got a bit of a clue based on Pat holding up this little box here. This here is ACRUX 1, or it's the final engineering model for ACRUX 1. That just bar maybe a few solar panels on the outside. So, a CubeSat is unlike other satellites, given the scale of the craft, as you can tell, right? So the beautiful thing about CubeSats is it allows teams like us, teams of students, to get access to space when we don't have access to the millions of dollars, let's say, that you'd need to be putting up something substantially larger. So in terms of what makes a CubeSat run, there are a few different subsystems or teams that I'll introduce briefly now, and then you'll hear from them throughout this evening. Now, I've been told by previous alumni of the ACROX mission that acronyms are not a thing to be used. So I'm hoping this is the last you'll see of them tonight. I haven't checked every single slide, so we'll see whether or not that's being lived up to. But just to run through them very quickly, we've got CAM up the top, so that's our camera payload. As Pat talked about, we're looking at doing an Earth observation mission. Then to actually make the satellite run, we have ADCS, which stands for Attitude Determination and Control Systems. It's a mouthful. Basically, where's the satellite pointing? How do we get it to where we want it to point? Then you jump through to BOX. It's basically the structural team of the satellite. They didn't have a fun acronym, so that's why it kind of doesn't match up, but it makes sense. Jumping through, we've got then comms. Basically, we need to be able to tell the satellite where to take a picture and get the photo back. EPS, got to keep that thing powered. If there's no power, it's no good, no satellite. And then OBC, bit of command and control, makes it all happen at the end of the day. So as Pat described, you know, we want to take a photo of Melbourne. And there are two fundamental reasons for that. Number one, it was outlined at the end of last year by the Australian Space Agency just how critical Earth observation is as a pathway forward for Australia. And it's something that we see investment flowing into even as we speak. And so we kind of thought, look, you know, sounds like an amazing opportunity to get involved. And two, it's just really cool, right? To be able to say that you've taken a photo of Melbourne, you know, personally, I might throw that one up on the mantle. You know, just such an amazing accomplishment to have there. Why do we also care about that, right? So it's cool. But what are those useful skills that we're developing? So Pat touched on this a little bit, but not only do we get these kind of hard skills, you know, that we talk about. So, you know, people are going to be working with CAD, they're going to be doing PCB design, but you also develop a lot of soft skills as well, right? So project management, being able to effectively communicate when the slides aren't there, making it up as you go along, stuff like that. Yeah, so it really is like this all-encompassing project that teaches you elements, you know, across the kind of that spectrum of engineering that will be invaluable as our members kind of go out into their career. So speaking of ACROX 2 graduates so far, again, we've had such success so far with members of our team going out to these places, you know, not just in research, you see a lot of PhD candidates up there, but also into that growing space industry in Australia. So, you know, off to Gilmore Space as an example. One of the previous team leads of the ACROX 2 mission is currently up there working on the first rocket. So it really is a fantastic kind of starting point for people who are interested in the space industry. And we also really want to be looking to grow these connections as well. So having more embedded mentorship with the team, right? Having people who are graduates working with us on the satellite and really strengthen that connection with research and with interest bodies around Australia.
From Melbourne University, that was Maxwell Jones, the ACROX 2 team lead at the Melbourne Space Program. At least he was in 2022 when we recorded that. Before that, we heard from Patrick Grave, the Chief Executive Officer of the Melbourne Space Program.
When you've seen the Southern Cross for the first time, you understand just why you came this way.
And next up, Andrew, we've got Nathan Udawela and Anthony Thomas. Who are they?
Okay, they are the camera communications team at ACROX 2, the Melbourne Space Program.
And what will they be covering?
How their subsystem to downlink the data is designed, the ground station service that's needed to bring the picture down, and the satellite module development, and also how they're going to need an advanced amateur radio license.
All right, let's hear from them now.
So, hey, everyone. My name is Nadun, and this is Anthony, and we are the subsystem leads for the communication subsystem. And in our team, we also have Ernest, Keshav, Lily and Andrew. So the primary objective for the comm subsystem is to develop the capability to frequently downlink 1 to 2 images, image data of up to 1 to 2 gigabytes. So we also have a secondary objective to downlink, occasionally downlink telemetry data about the state of health of the satellite, And we also want to occasionally uplink commands from ground to satellite so that we can control its position and orientation in space. In order to do this, we're pursuing the use of the S-band because it provides us with access to high data rates, which will allow us to downlink images. And we are also pursuing the use of the UHF band, which is more suitable for small telemetry packets. So COMS has three streams of development. So we have one is the development of the satellite communications module, which will be responsible for uplinking and downlinking data on the satellite side. We also have ground station development, which will support that uplinking and downlinking from Earth. And we also need to sort out licensing, which will give us permissions to transmit in UHF and S-bands. So for our UHF system, we'll be reusing much of the hardware and components used for Aquox 1. So after completing a preliminary link budget, we found out, we estimate that we'll have approximately 8 minutes contact time as the satellite passes overhead above Australia, above Melbourne. And this will be sufficient to meet, this will provide us with the capability to downlink approximately 0.5 megabytes of data, which is sufficient, we believe, to download simple telemetry data and uplink simple commands. But for the S-band, what we found is that using a single S-band ground station may not be sufficient to meet our requirements. After undertaking a similar link budget analysis as we did for the UHF ground station, using parameters from an ISIS-based ground station kit, we found that even though we have an estimated 8 minutes of signal reception for an overhead pass, we can only downlink about 0.3 gigabytes of data in this time frame, which will not be sufficient to meet our requirements. Furthermore, the cost of purchasing a S-band ground station far exceeds $90,000, which is a bit above our budgetary constraints. So as an alternative, we'll be pursuing the use of AWS's S-band ground station service, which will allow us to deploy multiple ground stations, S-band ground stations around the world. And this will allow us to more frequently downlink data, as well as downlink data at a more affordable cost. I'll now pass it to Anthony to talk about the satellite module development.
Thanks, Nadoon. So yeah, I'll talk about the satellite module development, which is related to the transceiver that will go on Aquox, the satellite itself. So it can be broken down into two different streams, the radio PCB development and also the embedded firmware development. I'll just talk a little bit about the radio PCB development. So designing RF PCBs, which are these printed circuit boards here, is not a simple task. And prior to this, prior to joining Aquox 2, our team does not have much experience. So recently we had a sprint task in which we designed three different filters. You can see them here, a low pass, a high pass, and a band pass filter. And you can see the different steps that we went through to design and then eventually manufacture this PCB. Unfortunately, it didn't arrive in time tonight, so we can't show it off, but that is what it will look like in the final result. While this task is a little bit simpler than our final system, it will provide a great foundation for our future work and our final system. So now I'll talk a little bit about the embedded firmware. So this is the code and the logic that will run our transceiver. We currently do not have a testing transceiver model, so we're using a development kit, which is the Texas Instrument board right there. And we're currently developing three different streams, which are local communication, which is useful to communicate with the OBC itself, RF message echoing, which is useful for testing, and then data packet design, which will also allow us to have greater control on the data that we send. We also have a demonstration later. So continuing on the satellite development, there are several things that we want to do. So firstly, we want to take all of our work so far and create a more full-fledged, complete system, which will be noted by the left PCB right there. This will likely be based on the open source project OpenLST to provide us a great foundation for development. We'll then be putting that together with a UHF antenna. UHF stands for ultra high frequency, by the way. Sorry about the acronyms. And then we'll be combining that with an S-band transmitter and antenna. Finally, we'll put that all together into the engineering model, which will then hopefully meet all our requirements. So I'll just talk quickly about the key milestones and learnings that we've had so far as a comms team. So the first thing is three of our members from MSP have been able to obtain the advanced amateur radio license, which is essential for communicating in the amateur radio band. We've also been able to download and decode a weather satellite image from a NOAA satellite, which is really exciting. We've also been able to build up our embedded programming knowledge using TI and STM platforms. Oh, yeah, systems requirement, I think, system design requirement.
Yep.
And then finally, the communications theory, which is related to link budgets, modulation schemes, and protocols. That's all from comms for now.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
And the space show is at Melbourne University in 2022. We're learning about the Melbourne Space Program, which is a student-led group aiming to build a satellite called Acrux 2. As I said at the beginning, I'm not sure if they're still active or not, but we'll take a listen anyway.
When you see the Southern Cross for the first time, you'll understand that's why you came this way.
And next up, we'll have Shazin Saifullah, who was the systems engineer with Acrux 2 at the Melbourne Space Program. Andrew, what will they be talking about?
What systems engineering is and how they had a changeover of the team doing the project, how they were enjoying their time with the Melbourne Space Program, and how CubeSat, although it's very tiny, is actually very complex.
So I was told to start this presentation with a philosophical question, which is, what is systems engineering? So as with any other philosophical questions, I went to Wikipedia and I found out that systems engineering is an interdisciplinary field of engineering and engineering management that focuses on how to design, integrate, and manage complex systems over their life cycles. And just in 2018, around the world, it was actually 325 1U CubeSats were launched and across 166 educational institutions and 47 countries. And obviously, I couldn't find the recent data, but we have to work with that. And this has allowed us to go through multiple research papers and analyze, for most of them, what actually went wrong and what they could have done to fix it. And usually, in terms of CubeSats, what failure usually means is never reaching that launch date. And so keeping that in mind, we have built our new and epic systems engineering team. This is actually the official name. It is the EPIC systems engineering team. We have brought in a graduate systems engineer in our systems, in our team, and who brings with him the experience and discipline which is key to a systems engineer. As for me, I have just started my Master's of Industrial Engineering, Acrux 2 is enabling me hands-on experience with the satellite manufacturing system. And this has given me the opportunity to work with experienced team members and also excellent industry alumnus. Going through those papers that I just mentioned, we found some common obstacles that CubeSats usually face. It is exceeding development time, which is MSP student organizations are run by students. Students, hopefully, they graduate. So what happens is we are usually every year we lose our experienced team members and then we have to bring in new members. So which poses a very difficult challenge on knowledge management and how knowledge is transferred from one team to the next one. And then there is a lack of system testing. This is usually due to the lack of availability of testing tools. So people who can give us resources, please. And there is a lack of requirements analysis, which includes misunderstanding and communication issues across the subsystems. And also, our team is inexperienced, but that is not a bad thing. This is what MSP stands for. We want new students to come in. We want them to learn from their mistakes. We learn through trial and error. Now, the main goal for systems engineering in Acrux 2 is to ensure consistent workflow and success of system-level goals for different phases of project life cycles and establish a solid team culture. I have been to, this is just going to be a promotion, I guess, but I have been to a lot of clubs at UniMelb, but I've never enjoyed my time as much as I have in MSP. I always thought that in order to find my, you know, mentors, I have to look for people in the industry and everything. But I just didn't know that how much you can actually learn from your friends. And even though MSP is a student-run organization, we're not doing a science project here. In the end of the day, we actually want to deliver a working product that meets our stakeholders' needs. For our engineering requirements, we are following the ISO 20091148 standard. What is that? I'll let you know when I find out, but it is basically a standard for requirements engineering. Then we ask, is our system validated? Is the system being developed in compliance with its specs and requirements? Example, and this is usually done through inspection, analysis, and testing. Is our system validated? Does it fulfill ACRUX 2 operational needs? Example, user interviews, prototyping, and demonstrations. And this process of requirements engineering and then moving to verification and validation allows us to finally develop our CONOPS, or concept of operations, which will lead us to building our CubeSat systems and architecture. CubeSat is a very, even though it's just a box with a Beyblade inside, this is what people tell me when I show them our work, but it is a very complex and highly dynamic system. It has multiple subsystems, and we need to figure out how do each subsystem communicate with each other? How does the ground station function with the satellite? Now, I can't wait to find out the answers to these questions and start building.
That was Shazam Saifullah, the systems engineer for ACRUX 2.
When you've seen the Southern Cross for the first time, you understand just why you came this way.
And now we have Daniel Digby, who is the team lead computer subsystems at the Melbourne Space Program. And he'll be talking about what, Andrew?
His role as a coordinator, how do you work out what a failure is, a sort of a hierarchy of failures, and the software architecture being designed. Now, I'd point out that Daniel moved off microphone. Yes, I had my microphone set up where they were all speaking, but Daniel, well, he went off microphone. So this is not up to the same standard as the other recordings we've had, but still I will reward you with a close attention.
Hello everyone, my name's Daniel. I'm the team lead for the onboard computer subsystem. We've recently expanded the team a bunch, and so the team names that I'm not going to enumerate them all. And in the interest of the short time budget, I'm going to keep moving through. So as a breakdown of the primary concepts involved in OBC, our responsibilities are essentially to coordinate and control the satellite. We coordinate all of the subsystems, we schedule work, we log and transmit or line up the transmission of telemetry, and importantly, we're also involved in failure detection, isolation, and recovery. The above manifest in CONOPS, as we've discussed earlier. And finally, the team was and is pretty new to embedded systems, and so there's been a lot of sort of learning along the way. So initially, over the sort of early days of the project, there was a long discovery phase. We needed to research and select a hardware and software stack to support all of the system requirements. We needed to architect software that satisfied the responsibilities and the system requirements in a way that was both maintainable and modular. We also needed to figure out how we were going to do FDIR. So we did a whole bunch of research into how we actually discern what we need to handle, and then also strategized for the implementation and how it's going to fit into the software architecture that we plan to create. So as a quick run through, we are planning to do failure mode analysis, which entails looking at the types of failures that occur and their potential causes, and fault tree analysis, which looks at individual failures and then tracks their propagation through the system and the symptoms that would then present. We're going to use these outcomes to define a failure hierarchy, so what failures can occur and what our responses are to those failures, And that failure hierarchy will then sort of cascade upwards as failures become more severe and will respond to them in different ways. That's going to inform the implementation in our software system. So the stack that I mentioned before, we've decided to go with C++ application business logic, which will be assisted by NASA's F-Prime C++ flight software framework. This gives us a lot of sort of tooling and things that are relevant to the project already, and hopefully mitigate some of the risk implementing it all ourselves. We then have an operating system abstraction layer, which allows this sort of framework stack to talk to the operating system running on our board. And we chose to run with FreeRTOS, which is a real-time operating system. And it gives us a little bit more control over when things occur. And that's necessary due to the really harsh environment that we're going to be running in. Finally, we decided to run on ARM core microprocessors as a hardware layer that will sort of read in all the inputs from our other subsystems and pass them up to us in the software world. So the outcomes of this discovery and research phase have been that we have planned a significant portion of our software architecture, which I'll go through on the following slide. We have also nearly completed the OSAL for F-Prime with FreeRTOS, which is a little bit novel. It's not officially supported by NASA because they choose to support enterprise solutions like VxWorks, which is another real-time operating system. And so we are following some sort of discussion threads and things like that with their software engineers on the internet in order to do that. I've also worked with some previous members of the team to set up much of our developer experience. So we have containerized development environments, continuous integration, which means like when we add new code to the project, we run a whole bunch of tests on it. Then we have also acquired a library of development hardware to run our code on. And as well, we've gone through some risk minimization strategies for our software. So we plan to do unit and integration testing, which is relatively standard for a software project. But also, we hope to have a really heavy emphasis on hardware and loop testing. We want to integrate our software with our team's hardware as early as possible in an agile manner, and hopefully automate some of this. So that final point there is saying that when we bring code into the sort of up-to-date code base, we hope to automate the process of deploying it onto our hardware and then automating inputs into it from our other subsystems, which should give us really, really high confidence when we approach launch that our system is going to behave as expected. If we can get automated testing running 24 hours a day on our sort of branch head, on our most recent version of the code, then I think that's a pretty exciting step for a student team. Onto the architecture. So we chose to go with a tree structure, and the reason that is because we care so much about the control of the order of which things happen in. We command this sort of tree structure with a process tick at the root node there, the command module. And then this speaks to what we're calling a CONOPS mode state machine. So we'll have one for each of the different CONOPS modes. For instance, like idle, in which the satellite is going in normal operation, safe, something horrific has happened and we've shut down everything but necessary systems. And each of these CONOPS modes will have a state machine, and the logic to follow that state machine will be defined within that section there. Beneath, they'll talk to subsystem controllers, which define and implement the API to talk to the microprocessors of our other subsystems. This is so that the code that drives that integration is really cohesive and is not heavily coupled to the rest of the system. Then we'll also, the reasoning for that final block there, the data bus adapters, is that at the moment with our system V, we're unsure exactly which buses all of our different subsystems will be using. So we wanted to be able to swap out the integration really easily. And to do that, we're planning to use a standardized internal packet. Finally, the FDIR that I mentioned earlier, we plan to insert at each given layer as our failure hierarchy is defined. This means that each of these modules here are going to be very, very focused and have singular responsibilities, but we can plug them in at any stage of the tree as data is sort of flowing upwards through it. And that means that as we fail in our hierarchy, those failures can cascade up. and be handled at the relevant level. Upcoming work for the team is to train the large pool of new recruits and also facilitate the growth of the new technical leads we've just brought on. We also want to implement a proof of concept slice of that tree architecture I just mentioned. The reason for this is that it allows us to be pretty agile with that planned architecture by building the minimum viable subsection, which means that if we learn or make mistakes, we haven't yet started building the whole system yet, and we can propagate that learning to the other slices as we go. We need to begin subsystem integration with our CAM and comms teams, and I also am really keen on implementing proof of concept hardware and loop testing, like I mentioned, after which we'll fully integrate and automate that hardware and loop with our CI/CD and begin the process of doing failure mode and fault tree analysis to discover that failure hierarchy that I have been talking so much about.
Well, that was Daniel Digby, the team lead of the computer subsystems at the Melbourne Space Program.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
And coming up next from Melbourne Uni, we have Ahmed Al-Dulimi and Sophia Shang, Earth Observation Systems for ACRUX 2 of the Melbourne Space Program. Andrew, what will they be covering?
Well, they've got a camera to operate, and this camera's got several purposes, and there are limits on the data it can do. And have you heard of machine learning? Well, they're going to use that to analyze the image. And they hope to also, in addition to get pictures of Melbourne City, do some bushfire imaging and using the infrared. And you never guess where they get the camera from. Let's take a listen.
All right. So I'm Ahmed. I'm the payload lead, the camera lead. And this is Sophia. We've basically been working together for like 3 to 4 weeks. We're one of the younger teams here. But we're basically responsible for building the camera and integrating all the software that goes with it. So why do we want to build a camera? Why do we want to observe the Earth? Well, basically, it's another data layer that we can use to build, gain data insights. And there's a wide, there's a growing field of use of Earth observation that's, you know, constantly growing. There's papers constantly coming out that you, say you can monitor health, you can look at your vegetation health. And so just going through a couple of them, here, this one, you can highlight vegetation. Subsystem of Sentinel-2 satellites. They are by the European Space Agency. They've been launched a couple of years now, or, you know, 5-7 years. But basically, you can highlight vegetation. And you can now do this image every time the satellite goes across Victoria. This is a French island in Victoria. So Mornington is top left. But you can do this image as many times as you want. And you can measure how vegetation is growing or decreasing across Victoria. Next image looks at vegetation water content, so the moisture inside the leaves or the trees. This one specifically goes for bushfire because, you know, dry fuel is what drives bushfire, and dry fuel is your soil is very dry, and so dry leaves can contribute to dry soil. So here we can see where the dry areas are, and that's basically your dry fuel-ish. And you can now, for bushfire mitigation strategies, where they burn this dry fuel before bushfire season, they now can have a clear image of knowing where should they burn. And even during bushfire season, they know where that bushfire might move towards. And the third one is water quality. So it's pretty straightforward. You don't want to drink that water that's colored. Avoid that. Okay, so the camera payload team is divided into two subsections. One subsection deals with data processing. And basically, after we get that image, what are we doing with it? And that's a couple of examples that you saw relate to the data processing team. And then the hardware development, which Sophia will talk about, relates to actually building the camera and integrating it within the OBC and the comms team. So regarding the data processing team, what is our main purpose? Well, as you saw, we're very restricted by the amount of bandwidth that we can send down and the amount of storage that we can store. So our best case scenario, we probably want to capture as many images as we can. If we can capture 1 million images and send them down, we would do that. But we can't do that. So our main purpose is to build algorithms to then run on the ACRUX 2 satellite on board So immediately after we take the images, we want to have a couple of algorithms that run in space, and then we also run a couple of post-processing, like the images you saw, once we get the image. Just to give you an insight, like, some fridges are sold and they have better computing power than what we're dealing with, so we're very restricted. All right, the first algorithm we built is cloud detection. This is used deep learning, machine learning AI, think of it that way, that looks at an image and says, this has too many clouds, or this doesn't have clouds, so great, save it. If that has too many clouds, we want to get rid of it. So we want the image on the right, we don't want the ones on the left. But maybe deep learning is overkill. So we actually looked at it and we said, okay, we need a far more efficient solution. So when you look at these images, the clouds really stand out. They're just white dots. So our efficient solution is we just take the image, we count how many number of white dots there are, and if that's a lot, we say this image is cloudy. So there are a couple of fail, like it does fail because it doesn't look at distribution. So if your clouds are all around and then there's a clear patch in the middle that's clear, yeah, the thing that counts the white dots says, yeah, that's a cloudy image. So you would miss that. And also if you want to take images of snow, you'll also miss them. But otherwise, it's very efficient. Second tool we built is a command line tool and has a kind of a library with it that you can use to download Sentinel-2 data. So here, basically, you put this, not technical guys, you write this command somewhere, and then you download 10 images. And so here we're specifying latitude, longitude. I would say we want 10 raw images, the latest raw images over this area, and we would download them. But a raw image from Sentinel-2 is between 2 to 3 gigabytes. So I don't know if you want to download 10. All right, so what are the next steps regarding the data processing side? Well, we want to build a bushfire image classification. That's what we're currently building. And we want to run that so that during bushfire season, if we know there's an overpass of a couple of bushfires, we want to turn that mode and be like, all right, from now on, only take pictures of bushfires. So we want to capture that bushfire imagery. And in doing so, we would need to build a bushfire data set of satellite imagery so we can train the algorithm. Basically, you tell the algorithm, here's 100 satellite bushfire images. This is what they look like. This is what they look like when there's no bushfire. And it's, okay, so for this one, does it have bushfire or not? That's like the basic deep learning algorithm. That's what it does. And us releasing a data set, Australian Space Agency is meant to release a data set. They have a grant from February, but unless we're releasing it in the next couple of weeks, we will release it before the Australian Space Agency. And basically, there isn't a major bushfire data set available publicly. The next is we want to find the near-infrared band from the RGB images. Basically, RGB is red, green, blue. This is a camera on your phones. It's every dot, every pixel is a combination of red, green, and blue colors. And that's the camera we're going to be flying. However, we're missing many wavelengths, and there's other wavelengths in terms of long wave, short wave, infrared, that all help us achieve the three images I showed you. But there's four papers that came out very recently from Germany, Russia, and Canada that look at RGB images, and they teach the algorithm, here are 100 RGB images, here are 100 near-infrared images, what is the near-infrared value for this image? And they get pretty decent accuracy, like 98-99%. So we want to take those algorithms, implement them, and then we want to build our own ones. And in doing so, we also need to build a data set. And then this is for just FlatSat V1, so approaching end of the year. Then moving on, we want to do a time series analysis. So look at over time, over a year, what is going on with vegetation, what's going on with water quality. We want to then optimize the models. That we have the deep learning ones, because again, the processor we're working with is very weak, so there's no point building something that works great, but can't run. So we're willing to sacrifice efficiency for that. Not efficiency, we're sacrificing quality. Then we want to build maps from RGB images. Again, if we're using those infrared layers, we can highlight where the crops are, where urban lands are, and then we can build an algorithm that just maps it immediately, and then we can look over time, the growth of urban areas, the growth of cropland. And then we want to, as you saw the three images before, there's about 40 right now, and there's new ones constantly coming out every year. We want to make those all work with RGB, or at least attempt to. All right, now for Sophia, for hardware development.
Cool. So on the camera side of things, what we're looking to do is to build a way to interface with the camera through an isolated environment. So right now, we've able to set up an isolated environment and to communicate with a dummy camera module since we don't have our physical camera just yet. So for this one, we just use an ArduCam and a Raspberry Pi 4. So the picture is just one that we took yesterday with our camera. So to do this, we interfaced with the camera module's SPI and I2C communication buses. And to convert the data stream that we have into a viewable image, we had to reverse engineer their code and then to convert it ourselves with our own scripts, because they only provided us with a third-party software, which we obviously don't really want to use. So for the next steps for FlatSat V1, we have two different tracks going on. So for the first one, we want to be able to convert the data that we get from the image and send it to Ahmed scripts so that we can run it through, like test to see if there's clouds or like extract information such as, you know, water quality, vegetation, or whatever research purposes that we have at the time. And obviously to integrate it with OBC and comms. On the other side, because we know that lead times for cameras are really long, so like 6 months to a year, maybe even more, we would want to start working with our physical camera as soon as we can. So our work for that is that we want to be able to get an off-the-shelf camera and then, you know, spacify it, so make it space gray. So that includes tearing down the casing and then building our own chassis for it, implementing thermal control, and then like ruggedizing the chassis. So that will have to go through vibration, pressure, and thermal testing. So at the end of the day, we've had to upskill on a lot of embedded development, which I personally have pretty much no experience before, and also working with machine learning, which I also don't really know much about. And then going forward, we're hoping to get more experience with deep learning, image processing, creating our own data pipeline, all that kind of stuff, and building a camera and spacifying it.
They were Ahmed Al-Dulaimi and Sophia Chiang from the Earth Observation System on the ACRUX 2 satellite project at the Melbourne Space Program.
When you see the Southern Cross for the first time, you understand just why you came this way.
And now we have Vicky Huang, also with ACRUX 2 at the Melbourne Space Program. And Andrew, what's she covering?
Well, they're going to try and deploy a canister, you know, and switches for deployment of the satellite. They're doing a test. They've got a test rig and rather low friction bearings on the test rig. Let's take a listen.
Hi, I'm Vicky, and I'll be presenting on behalf of the chassis. And that includes Tori over here, Patrick over there, and our remote team, Sarah and Aiden. Yeah, so the chassis team is responsible for creating enclosures that protect other subsystems from loads pre-launch and post-launch. And that includes our thermal loads and also our vibrational loads. So what Tori is holding up here is one of our outer box designs. We have designed these for the Maxwell launch dispenser. So depending on which launch provider we go with, we're going to have to alter the chassis in terms of fitting it in. So that's why we've gone with some modular designs and something that allows us to be able to make changes really quickly with very few parts. So when we have develop these, we developed some 3D printing skills, laser cutting skills, but these will in the end be CNC'd, so we're going to have to learn how to design for CNC as well. As well as these outer boxes, we also designed some mechanical mechanisms for subsystems, such as the separation switches. So this one here is designed actually for EPS, and what it does is that when the chassis gets ejected out from the launch provider after launch, it needs to switch on the whole electrical power system for it to function and complete the rest of the mission. So outside of the actual box and the chassis that's being launched into space, we also have some components for ground systems. So this is a communications box that's UV resistant, dustproof, and waterproof. And some of our members developed laser cutting skills and designed one of these that will be containing some of our comms components. And also, as part of the chassis, we also have a simulation team. So later on, we'll be doing some vibrational analysis to design for vibrational loads during launch, and also doing thermal simulation of the whole Cube satellite. So our short-term goal is to develop a testing rig capable of validating ADCS's reaction wheel control scheme. And that means we need to redesign the CubeSat to include ADCS components. So basically, we're designing a better version of this. So when we considered how we're going to do that, we needed very much to consider what kind of loading we're going to put on it. So there's the rotational loads and also the mechanical loads. So when we designed it, we needed to account for the types of reaction wheels being changeable. And so looking into that, we looked into lots of different bearings and did a whole bunch of cost comparisons in terms of installation costs of buying the reaction wheels, putting them on, some operational costs in terms of what resources we need in order to run each test, and also maintenance costs in terms of keeping the rig at tip-top shape. We need to consider modularity because of ADCS design changes that will be happening rapidly, and also changing from one axis rotation to two axis. We want to be able to reuse a lot of our designs, which will be informed by how we designed the first axis. So in bearing selection, we did a little bit of a cost-benefit analysis. We initially were going to go with air bearings, which are very low friction, and we looked into ball bearings as well as thrust bearings in a gimbal configuration. But in the end, we decided that it had very high maintenance costs and it required a air filtration systems or cylinders of compressed air to be brought into different environments. So there were very limited environments where we can test the reaction wheels. So we looked into ceramic bearings. So in terms of using ceramic bearings, we currently are using, I think, ceramic bearings, but we're looking into using some angular contact bearings, which can take axial loads and would also decrease the amount of setup time required to run each test. In terms of mounting the reaction wheels, we've worked with ADCS to work on this sort of sliding mechanism, which would be able to mount any new designs as well, and it will inform how we mount all of the other subsystems as well. So the idea behind this is that it's modular and usable, and the primary aim is for reaction wheel mount, but with the sliding mechanism, we do reduce vibration loads for anything that is mounted vertically like that, and we have also decreased the amount of fastening holes from our original designs here to reduce the impact on structural integrity, and later when we run FEA models, it will increase accuracy of our simulations as well. We're also looking into some electronic leveling systems to be applied on there, so then when they apply the reaction wheels on top, they know that it is mounted in the correct orientation. So the next steps for chassis in terms of FlatSat is that we're looking into creating an integrated model with ceramic bearing setup and a little gimbal setup, a new frame and leveling system. We want to integrate ADCS's reaction wheels and create a good weight distribution scheme to be able to inform mounting systems in the flight model, because in our flight model, we need the center of mass to be within 1 to 2 centimeters of the geometric center.
And that was Vicky Huang from ACRUX 2, the Melbourne Space Program, and we recorded those talks in 2022. We're not sure if the project is still active or not. Well, I'm Andrew Rennie, and we've had Richard on the controls as well here on the Space Show, which will be back on air next Wednesday.